Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk on the Kalama Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha teaches the Kalamas how to know a useful and effective Dhamma practice and how false Dhammas arise. This talk includes Sangha Q&A and discussion and was recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on October 15, 2016. This talk concludes with meta-intentional meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
Talk and article is on the Kalama Sutta, and this is similar to Tuesday's Sutta on the Saddhama, Tuesday's talk on the Saddhama Sutta. And it's been a rather common thread through the Pali Canon where people are asking the Buddha, how do you discern between all the other teachings that are out there? How do you discern what yours is, and how do we know that it's effective? And the Buddha didn't teach anything that was faith-based. Everything that he taught was to be practically experienced and understood, and so that's what his answers are consistently. And this is just a quote from the Dhammapada that the Buddha used often, describing what his Dhamma is. Abstain from wrongdoing, work for the good of all, purify your mind. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Pretty simple and direct. Slow down? I can't.
Okay.
I had a cup of coffee this morning. A rare cup of coffee. So. In the Kalama Sutta, the Buddha addresses greed, aversion, and deluded thinking directly as a way of pointing out the effectiveness of his Dhamma. The Buddha then uses the qualities of generosity, non-clinging, and well-concentrated mindfulness developed through the Eightfold Path as the framework for Dhamma practice. The Buddha points out that through awakening developed within the framework of the Eightfold Path, one becomes mindful and imbued with equanimity, free of ill will, undefiled, and pure. The Buddha consistently presented the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path as unique and distinct, not as a common teaching that could be integrated into other teachings according to the beliefs of individuals. It is the insistence that the Buddha's teachings can and should be accommodated to individual and cultural beliefs that have resulted in a confusing and ineffective dharma. He instructed the Kalamas to not, the Buddhist quote, to not go by others' accounts or by legends or traditions, do not follow scriptures, meaning later developed texts, or logical conjecture, conditioned thinking, do not form conclusions through inference, analogies, or common agreement. The Kalama Sutta. The Buddha was walking with a large group from the Sangha. They arrived at Kasaputta, the town of the Kalamas. The Kalamas have heard that the Buddha was an awakened human being who teaches a complete path that is admirable in the beginning, in the middle, and in its conclusion. The Kalamas went to the Buddha and told him of the many teachers that come through their town, all claiming to have taught the one true Dhamma, while ridiculing other teachers and their teachings. They asked the Buddha, how are we to know which is a useful and effective Dhamma and what is not? The Buddha replies, of course you are uncertain and filled with doubt. When there are reasons for doubt, uncertainty will follow. Do not go by reports or legends or traditions or scripture or conjecture or inference or analogies or common agreement or even unexamined loyalty. When you know from your own experience that the qualities taught are unskillful, shameful, confusing, and distracting, these teachings should then be abandoned. When these teachings are criticized by the wise, they should be abandoned. When these teachings lead to harm and suffering, they should be abandoned. So what do you think, Kalamas? When the three defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking arise in a person, do they arise for benefit or for harm? The defilements always bring harm. And when a person is driven by the defilements, their mind possessed, they kill other beings, they take what is not given, they take another spouse, they lie and induce others to lie, all of which create long-term harm and suffering for themselves and others. So what do you think, Kalamas? Are these defilements skillful or unskillful, shameful or shameless, criticized or praised by the wise? The defilements are unskillful, shameful, and criticized by the wise. When the defilements are acted upon, do they lead to long-term suffering for oneself and others or not? They always lead to long-term suffering for oneself and others. So as I said, do not go by reports or legends or traditions or scripture or conjecture or inference or analogies or common agreement or even unexamined loyalty. When you know from your own experience that the qualities taught are unskillful, shameful, confusing, and distracting, these teachings should be abandoned. In other words, he's not saying, giving a blanket statement to disregard everything you ever hear, but what he's saying is examine. Simply examine what you're developing, and if it leads to the end of the defilements, keep it going, and if not, simply abandon it. It's just common sense advice. When these teachings are criticized by the wise, they should be abandoned. In other words, someone that you know has developed an understanding of life, and they're also saying this may not be helpful, listen to them. When these teachings lead to harm and suffering, they should be abandoned. Now, again, do not go by reports or legends or traditions or scripture or conjecture or inference or analogies or common agreement or unexamined loyalty. Again, when you know from your own experience that the qualities taught are skillful, shameless, unambiguous, meaning direct, these teachings should be developed. When these teachings are praised by the wise, they should be developed. When these teachings lead to unbinding and calm, they should be developed. So that's a clear direction on what the purpose is. Do they lead to unbinding and a mind that is developing calm? Then you should continue to develop it. What do you think, Kalamas? When the defilements do not arise in a person, is this for their long-term welfare and happiness and for others' long-term welfare and happiness? They are for everyone's long-term welfare and happiness. And this person, free of the defilements, does not kill living beings or take what is not given or take another spouse or lie or induce others to lie. So what do you think? Are these qualities skillful, shameless, and praised by the wise? They are, sir. When developed and acted on, they bring long-term welfare and happiness to oneself and others. Now, Kalamas, one who follows the Dhamma, free of greed, aversion, or deluded thinking, alert and mindful of the path, experiences their life imbued with goodwill. Everywhere they go, their mindfulness is imbued with goodwill, with gratitude, with a mind resting in equanimity. They are abundant and free from all agitation towards themselves and all humanity. I like that line there, they are abundant. They freed themselves from all the things that are limiting them, and they are now abundant in their own life. When one follows the Eightfold Path, free from greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, undefiled and pure, there are four qualities they will naturally develop. One, they will give rise to pleasant experiences in the present, meaning as their life unfolds. They will give rise to pleasant experiences in the future. There's nothing left in their life now to create an unpleasant or unsatisfactory experience, one of the goals of the Dhamma. If harm is done with no intention, no suffering will touch them. In other words, if just as a consequence of living in the world, you may cause something to create an unsatisfactory experience, but it's without intention, there's no karmic debt to be paid with it. And four, if I remain harmless, then I can know that I am pure and no suffering will touch them. And that points to the freedom that comes from developing the Eightfold Path. And you no longer then have to second guess yourself as far as your behavior, your thoughts, words, and deeds, because you know they fall within this framework that promotes constantly virtuous behavior. These are the four qualities naturally developed in one free of the defilements from following the Dhamma. The Kalamas then said, "Great teacher, you have shown a way to those who were lost. Through clear reasoning, you have made the Dhamma clear and taught us how to know a true Dhamma. We take refuge in you, the great teacher, in your Dhamma, and in your Sangha. Please remember from this day forward that we have taken refuge." That's the end of the sutta. The Kalama Sutta concludes with the Buddha describing the results of awakening directly through the Eightfold Path. Now, Kalamas, when one who follows the Dhamma, free of greed, aversion, or deluded thinking, alert and mindful of the path, they experience their life imbued with goodwill. Everywhere they go, their mindfulness is imbued with goodwill, with gratitude, with a mind resting in equanimity. They are abundant and free from all agitation towards themselves and all humanity. So there's a little bit more, but I think that's enough of the sutta. So what do you think? Any questions or comments on that?
Again, it's spoken by the Buddha, and it's very clear and direct and good advice.
Yeah, and he's just reminding a community that so Kesaputta was on the trade route, so they got probably every known spiritual teacher at the time came through there. And they became increasingly confused. How do we choose? How do we know? And they realized that you can't practice at all because a lot of them were contradictory. And again, the Buddha didn't say, well, look, I'm the Buddha, you follow me. He said, these are the teachings. Develop it yourself and see for yourself. That ehepasiko, come and see for yourself. And that is something that sets the Buddha's teachings apart from faith-based religions. It's just a simple, I don't even like to call it a philosophy, but a simple direct practice that we experience ourselves. And it can be incorporated into any religious practice if you want to do that. There's nowhere where the Buddha ever said, don't practice something else. But he said, this is what this is. And the importance of that is just to keep the practice itself pure. And then you can do whatever you want with it. It's an important teaching that the Buddha returns to often simply because he's questioned about it often. You know, and think about that from 2,600 years ago to today. You know, there was still a lot of confusion. Deb?
Well, you said that thing about karma, that you want to have karma, but I thought karma was related to future, past lives, you know, having other lives. And I didn't think that the Buddha believed in that or preached that.
It's a very good question. There was much of the spiritual teaching during the time of the Buddha was based on the Vedas and adaptations to the Vedas, which would become modern Hinduism. The Buddha studied those with two of the most famous teachers and rejected that. But part of the teaching in that is a teaching on karma, and it's mostly presented as something that relates to past lives and future lives. It was always presented as almost like punishment for your actions. So the Buddha used the word karma, but he taught it in a realistic way that relates to the Four Noble Truths. So the way the Buddha taught karma is that karma is the present unfolding of your past intentional actions, but modified by the present level of your mindfulness. In other words, if your mindfulness is becoming framed by the Eightfold Path, then your unfolding karma can be directed towards awakening through developing the Eightfold Path, and with the ultimate goal of bringing the results of intentional actions to cessation that would normally lead to more confusion, delusion, and suffering. So another word to use for karma is conditioned thinking. Another word for karma would be anatta, not self, because it's those views that are unfolding that are creating karma. The Buddha also mentioned rebirth, but not in the same context. So the Buddha didn't say there's no such thing as reincarnation, but he did say what's most important is that your present actions will determine what you're giving birth to in a possible future human rebirth. But what's most important about karma and rebirth is what you're giving birth to in this moment. And that's where the refined mindfulness that's developed through the Eightfold Path brings our attention and our mindfulness. So it really doesn't have much to do with the baggage that we're dragging from past lives or even past experiences in this life and what they might bring in a future life. It's to look at the results of your thought, words, and deeds right now, what's occurring in your life right now, because right now is where your karma is unfolding. It's not helpful to think about, like some people take karma as punishment and they're walking around under a dark cloud their whole life, or that it's gaining favor from some creator god that's showing favor to you as an individual. You've got good karma. Or that it's something that you can directly affect by doing good works without that refined mindfulness. In other words, a lot of times merit is taught, like if you just financially support someone, you're going to get good karma. Well, if your intention behind it is pure, then you might. But if it's to manipulate your own karma, you're just creating more eye-making and more confusion. So it's a misunderstood teaching as far as the Buddha taught it. One of the reasons why I teach karma and rebirth occasionally here is because of that. And there's a couple articles on the website on karma and rebirth and some talks that will go into this deeper. But do you see the difference there between the general understanding of karma and the useful application of it? There's even some, and quite a bit of mention that the Buddha didn't really believe in karma, and some people will say he didn't believe in rebirth, but he only talked about it because other people were. And when you read what the Buddha said about it, it's just not true. It's a very important teaching. In fact, I think it's key to understanding the entire Dhamma, to understand karma and rebirth as it applies to the Four Noble Truths, recognizing craving and clinging and abandoning that so that we can give birth to a moment that is pure and free of agitation. And again, that's what's most important. So it points to the potential of each moment. Each moment that we live holds the potential to continue in developing awakening, full human maturity, or to continue our own ignorance of Four Noble Truths and continue confusion, delusion, and suffering. And it's on that point that the three marks of existence exist: impermanence, the not-self characteristic, and unfolding dukkha, or unsatisfactory experiences. And it all points back to, okay, what am I going to create in this moment? Because that's my karma. That's what I'm giving birth to. So what I was referring to in this talk, the cessation of karma, in that sense, means the cessation of creating any more confusion in your life, deluded thinking, and unfolding karma, unfolding unsatisfactory experiences. So it's an important question. Thank you for bringing it up. It really ties into what we're talking about today. Karma is such a simple, direct teaching, but in one hand, it really covers the entire Dhamma. What are you going to give birth to in this moment? That's really the most important thing. And that's the power of something that's not faith-based, because something that's faith-based is always based in the future, isn't it? If I just act a certain way right now, at some point, I'll get my reward. Suffering is even often taught that way, that there's a value to suffering, because if you suffer through this life, that's okay. Do it with this grim determination, do it with some stoicism, and in the future, you'll get rewarded. Well, the Buddha, that may be true. The Buddha never said it's not true. He just said what's most important is how we live this human life, not something in the future that is pure conjecture. How do I create lasting peace and happiness right now in this life? And that's what the Buddha set out to understand, and that's what he developed understanding. What's so important about tomorrow or the next life? I'm living my life here right now. And that's when I finally got that, it changed my whole experience of the Buddhist teaching. I realized what I wanted to know is exactly what the Buddha wanted to know. How do I live the most fulfilling, skillful, meaningful life right now? Because this is the only life that I know that I can live. I don't know anything about the future. Great class. Any other questions or comments?
You mentioned in your talk on your website that the Kalamas was a village or a small town.
Well, the Kalamas were what the people of Kesaputa were called. So if I wrote it that way, I probably need to change it. And I don't know why they were called the Kalamas, because they weren't from Kalamas, they were from Kesaputa. But, you know, that was what... It might have been a clan name, like... Siddhartha was often... Or the Buddha was often called a Shakyan or a Sakyan, because he was from the Sakyan Republic. So that might have been, they might have been from the Kalama Republic, but I don't know that. Probably something like that. Had to do with their tribe or their affiliation. And in northern India at the time, there was a lot of these little kingdoms.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't just one big giant kingdom. And they were often at war. But it's another story.
As life was in those days.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't idyllic. It was just as much difficulties and strife and trouble in the world then. The only real difference was we didn't know the global immediacy of it like we do now, but the problems were all the same. And his solution, even to the, you know, to the politicians and the rulers, when he would meet with them, he would always give them practical advice, like, you know, we're coming up with war, what should I do here? And some of it was, well, the war is unavoidable, but this is how you should act when you take prisoners. And so he wouldn't say you can't do it, but he would understand the common sense approach as this is unavoidable, but this is how you can make the best out of a good situation. Treat your prisoners well. Don't put people under undue burden once you conquer them. Support them. Give them what they need. Be a compassionate ruler if you're going to be a ruler. And that changed the face of northern India at the time, too. And I think it still has effects today. King Ashoka was a good example of that. His ideas of treating people with compassion and love and support and seeing your role as a ruler to help people that you're ruling over rather than to conquer them. He was the first one, the first ruler that we know of, at least, that started universal health care 2,600 years ago. That worked, by the way. But he also started universal veterinary care. He developed such a love for animals that he set up a system to take care of animals in a loving and compassionate way. Yeah, it really is. And he was probably one of the most bloodthirsty rulers the world ever saw up until that point. All over northern India at the time, this is about 250, 300 years after the death of the Buddha, when he would conquer a town, he would take their heads and put them on pikes, put them on poles. So you'd see huge areas covered with this gruesome scene. He took to the Dhamma, awakened, and he never harmed another soul. He became one of the most gentle, like the Buddha, became just an incredibly gentle human being because of that transformation. Pointing out that any conditioned mind can change with the right framework. You know, it's just remarkable.
I need to remember that. Would you say?
Yeah.
I need to remember that. My conditioned mind can change.
Right. Yeah. Well, it is. It's important to remember that if they can do it, I can do it. You know, they're just simply human. The sutta about Angulimala, the murderer, you know, how he changed just by having almost a chance encounter with the Buddha, never harmed another soul. But we can experience that. I mean, I know that I was kind of born angry, and I didn't have any outer violence, but I had a lot of violence in me. That came up with frustration. And as I developed the Dhamma, most of it left, maybe all of it. You know, I don't get that frustration with other people. I don't need other people to be different, and it doesn't lead to that type of feelings inside me. And it's simply because of the Dhamma. Nothing else changed that. You know? Well, that's it.
Do you ever feel that you need to be changed in any way? Are you totally content with who you are?
Well, that's a great question. So I don't talk about myself much, but I just did, so I guess I have to now. So, well, only because I also learned, reading the Pali Canon, you realize the Buddha did not refer to himself as an individual often, but he did occasionally talk about his own. So I do occasionally, and it's a fair question, too.
I mean, I know you want to be 6'4" with broad shoulders and...
Oh, I used to. The answer then is, as my life unfolds, I am at peace with what's unfolding, including myself right now. And I don't think many people can say that, and I certainly couldn't say that for most of my life. I didn't know from when I was a young kid and a teenager, when you start becoming self-aware, I was full of self-loathing, how's that for a word? Like many people are. And it was kind of reinforced in my environment, too. And we're taught in the West that we're basically a work in progress all the time. We're trying to fix something that's broken, and we're always trying to become better. There's nothing wrong with that, but it has to be in the right context. So I took that on, too, that there was a lot of stuff wrong with me, and I need to be fixing this broken self. And you can't. But I kept doing it because that was reinforced around me. It was reinforced by my school, my parents, some therapists that I saw, a few judges along the way.
Don't go on. We So,
so I would do everything that I'm being told to do, and yet I'm becoming more and more confused, more and more frustrated with myself, and putting it all on myself until I realized those are all just views, and they're all temporary views. When I started to learn to accept myself just as I am in the moment, knowing that there's still some things to change and abandon, that I could do that, because now I had the proper framework, like the Buddha's saying here. I had something to weigh myself against, or it's often referred to as the mirror. I could shine this mirror on my own thoughts, words, and deeds, and know specifically what was causing confusion, delusion, and suffering in my life. And those are the things that I could change. So I recognize that I'm not the most perfect human being, but that's okay. I don't need to be anymore. What has changed profoundly in me is I understand that I am in a constant process of becoming. And that becoming has to do with what I'm holding in mind in the moment and what I'm referencing or using as a reference to my life, to create this life. The more that I abandon creating, I making, seeing myself and taking things personal, the more at peace I am. And the more at peace I am, the more I'm eager to stop creating situations where I'm sticking an ego personality into it. Because it's that ego personality that's prone to suffering. The ego personality isn't me. As you develop awakening, full human maturity, you realize that the ego is simply a function of the mind. It's a point of reference rather than a self-referential way of living in the world, meaning all-consuming ego personality. I think it was Helen that said the other, it's a great description of the ego as a function of the mind rather than something that rules your life. The ego as a function of the mind simply stops you from walking in the trees.
I'm not aware. You know, I haven't got there to get that. I know.
You will.
I haven't got
that. You've made great strides. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Having said that, I've never heard, I don't think, of the Four Noble Truths being referred to as a mirror. And that's helpful. That you can look at that, look at yourself, and have that mirror image from...
Oh, yeah.
I've never put that here. I can see that.
When the Buddha describes right or fully developed right view, he, again, very simple, direct terms. Fully developed right view means that the true nature of dukkha in its entire application is understood, meaning fully comprehended. We fully penetrate the nature of dukkha, of unsatisfactory experiences of suffering in the human life. And then he says, right view is a view that has allowed you to abandon craving and clinging. You abandon the cause of your own unsatisfactory experience. When he described an awakened human being, he used the same terms. An awakened human being is unbound or released from clinging. Clinging to what? Clinging to self-referential views.
Yeah.
That's the entire Dhamma. Again, it sounds almost too simple, except when you start understanding and penetrating that, it's everything. It's changing everything that you see about the world in your relationship to the world. You no longer create identities over things that are impermanent. Ultimately, you realize that your thoughts are impermanent. So you don't fool yourself anymore by creating an identity based on your thoughts. So I might as well finish that. So then he described right view in relation to the third noble truth as you have experienced the cessation of that ongoing process of dukkha. And right view as it relates to the fourth noble truth is that you have fully developed the Eightfold Path. Everything relates back to the Four Noble Truths. Everything's a mirror of the Four Noble Truths. So when you use it that way and you feel agitation come up, a good example would be you fall into an argument with someone else. And you recognize, I think we might have talked about this Wednesday night, I'm not sure, in Flemington. And you recognize that the agitation from both parties is coming up through that first noble truth. There's an unsatisfactory experience in life rooted in craving and clinging. And this other person is expressing what they're craving for and what they're clinging to, their point of view. And now you're coming back with what you're craving for and clinging to, and it creates more agitation. If you let go of the need to be right, to express your craving and clinging, to express your need to continue that, then the situation resolves and calm prevails. At least in you, it might not be the other person. You know, sometimes people get a hold of a view like a dog with a bone. They won't let it go, but you know, there's nothing we can do about that. We're only in control of how we feel and how we react in the world. But oftentimes when we promote our own peace and calm, it allows other people to relax and calm down. And that's just the nature of things.
So you said on Wednesday night that if you're for something, you're also against something.
Yeah.
You know, there's that.
You need to be, it's just a matter of seeing things clearly. So most people in the world are for a healthy environment and, you know, no violence, etc. It's one thing to live your life that way, to be free of violence, to be free of harm to the planet that we live on. But it's another thing to take up a cause and create an identity over, I'm a stout environmentalist and everybody that doesn't throw away their paper cups is wrong. Well, you're creating agitation in the world and in your own mind. The only thing we can do is put the paper cup in a proper receptacle. Because that's what we do. That's what's right for me to do. But it's hurtful for me to say, you better do it too, because I do it. That thought that everybody's got to do what I do is what's created all the trouble in the world anyway, isn't it? So if you're for, and again, you can be for something and not necessarily be against something, but usually it is. Usually we create an identity that I'm right, you're wrong, and that's where the problem lies. That if you're for something, you're usually against something or someone else. Rather than just recognize it's a mindful way of living in the world. To live with sensibilities, not overconsume. It's one of the things that the Buddha taught in a very subtle way, was that it's hurtful to yourself and others to overconsume anything, including food. You know, one of the reasons why they didn't create big storehouses of food is because of that simple reason. I have more food than you do. They got up every day and got their bowl of food. That was enough. It created a very simple life for them too. So another great question. Good class. Any other questions?
I could take words you say any day of the week and learn something.
Well, thank you. And understood that what I say is it's inspired by what I learned through the Buddha's teaching. You wouldn't want to listen to me 20 years ago, 30 years ago. But I was teaching. There was a time I was in my mid to late 30s, and I was leading these spiritual echo tours all over Hawaii, and I was uncomfortably full of myself at the time. And I don't really think I caused any harm for people, but I certainly misled a lot of people, you know, inadvertently, because I didn't really know what I was talking about, and I was a little bit into shamanism and soul retrieval and that kind of stuff, and that's all fine, but it wasn't, I wasn't teaching anybody how to develop a calm and peaceful mind, I don't think. Had a lot of fun.
You hopefully enjoyed Hawaii while you're living there.
Oh, it was incredible. It really, I was really fortunate to have that, how it developed, and I got a little bit of a reputation. The native Hawaiians, it's really unfortunate what happened to the native Hawaiians. They really lost their culture, and they had the Polynesian culture had a worldwide economy. It was a model of human development, and then we came in and destroyed. So you're doing everything wrong. You're a bunch of savages, and they lost an incredible culture. So there was a time while I was doing this, I got a bit of a reputation, and they wanted me to, I developed an understanding of the ancient Hawaiian ways, and they wanted me to start bringing this into schools because they realized that their kids had lost everything. They lost their culture. And I started developing the program, and then some things happened in my life, and I never did that. But, yeah, it was a lot of fun. Hawaii is an amazing place.
I did live there for a couple of years.
Where?
I lived in Oahu and Kauai.
Ah, boy, just incredible places, aren't they?
Yeah, that's where my ex-husband was from, and so I had my child, and we lived there for a couple of years.
Wow, was he Hawaiian?
He was Chinese Hawaiian.
Wow, yeah. Was he interested in the old culture?
Oh, yeah, some. Family still has some old property on Hanapepe with those old buildings.
Wow.
It's interesting. The whole Menahunes, the little people.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we used to communicate with them on these.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, you brought back some memories. There was a retreat center I used to use on Big Island in near Kahana Beach. Beautiful place, a big black sand beach. And the woods were full of the Menahun. Menahun were little people that did some tricky little things. But and so whether it's true or not, I mean, while I was experiencing it and teaching people about it, it was certainly real. So now I kind of look at it as it's a nice figment of my imagination that was very distracting to most of us, but we had a great time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's it. You can have a great time with the distractions.
Well, it leads to...
We're getting back to the real Dharma now, but I love my distractions.
Yeah, well, and again, people got what they paid for because we had a great time, but no real... It could have been bowling camp for all the usefulness that people got out of it, but there's nothing wrong with enjoying yourself in paradise either. And I certainly was as sincere as I could be at the time. I just didn't really know what I was talking about. Hopefully I do now.
Well, and who knows? Some people, you know, it might have been, we all have had these spiritual journeys where maybe we're ending up here right now. But,
yes.
But that was part of the journey that led us to here.
I agree with that mostly. Mm-hmm. But I also look at, I don't want to use the word waste, but I spent a lot of time going through things to find out what they weren't. And maybe that was necessary to get to, you know, even this talk today, the Kalamas are going through the same thing. How do we know?
Yeah.
So I guess you have to have, and even the Buddha had a lot of experiences, very intense experiences, so that he could say, well, it's not that, it is this. And I think maybe as human beings, that's just part of our development. In that way, I wouldn't change anything. On the other hand, it would have been nice to know what I know now when I was 15, sure. But it doesn't work that way. You know? Yeah. But what I'm most grateful for, besides some great parents, what I'm most grateful for is that these teachings are still here and I still have a mind that's able to understand them. And not that I need any special type of mind, but I have a human mind that can take to these teachings, which is how the Buddha taught it for human beings. What a great class this morning. Any other questions, comments? Great discussion for just the three of us, too. one quick announcement, I think. Oh, a few announcements. The introductory talk at Hunterdon Wellness Center has been canceled. They felt like there was no reason to give a talk on a Friday night when you're going to be teaching on a Thursday night. And I wasn't going to argue with them. I don't know why. Anyway, I just said, okay. You know, so there won't be any introductory talk, but we'll start the class the next week. So I hope maybe you could bring Donna then.
Yes.
And that's what I thought. I said, well, okay, there was 6 or 7 people signed up. I said, well, you just let them know they can come to class. So there will be no introductory class, but I'll start teaching in Clinton on Thursday, November 3rd at 7 o'clock.
November what? 30th?
November the 3rd.
3rd.
The first Thursday in November. Donna Dinner, November 22nd. Info on the website.
I think Donna wanted to come to that.
Great.
She doesn't know what it is, but I told her so.
She'll find out. It's just a nice community dinner where, you know, we get, as a Sangha, we get together, but also the whole community is really wonderful. Now I'm glad we started that. The one-day retreat coming up in December will be December 4th, and I'll put some info on the website. It's probably going to be from like 10 to 3. Matt's going to be a part of it, and so will Maura. So.
How much does that cost?
I think $25, but always a donation too. You know, don't money never should keep people from doing coming to what we do here. And then I think the week after that, we're going to start another 10-week Truth of Happiness course, because it really went well over the holidays last winter, so we'll do it again this year. And
so the Dhamma retreat, it comes before the Clinton classes start?
No, actually, just after. The Clinton stat classes are going to start November 3rd, and the one-day retreat is December 4th, a month later.
So it's about a month after.
Yep. And then we'll start the Truth of Happiness course right after that, right here. And do the same thing we did last year, the same class on Tuesday and Saturday. So if you can't make one, you can make the other and keep up, or if it snows or something.
Yes.
And that worked out well, too. So. All right, let's finish with metta. Find your relaxed meditative posture. And gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And just get a feel for what that's like. And let that mindfulness of your breath in your body cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. And in metta, the first object of our meditation is always ourselves. And generating feelings of deep love and compassion for the object of our meditation. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. And now bring to mind those that you care deeply for, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. And now bring to mind those you may be in conflict with, difficult relationships, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. And now bring to mind each other in this room this morning and all the other members of our Sangha, and extend your awareness outside of this room, across our community, across our planet, across all creation to include all sentient beings. And generating those same feelings of deep love and compassion for all sentient beings. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. And this concludes our meditation practice for this morning. Thank you for being here. Peace.
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com.
We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.